to case 13-1235, Orton Bell versus Indiana. And good morning, Mr. Darst.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Thank you, and may it please the Court.
I feel like tonight, but it isn't.
You're doing hard work today. The parties in this case are in agreement that the plaintiff was a very good employee. The plaintiff complained at the Pendleton Correctional Facility about sexual harassment. She complained finally about employees, or she complained about someone using her office after hours because of things moved in her office. And the internal affairs investigator reported to her not to worry because it was only staff members having sex on her desk. And this was also happening on the desk of her assistant that she supervised. The plaintiff, Ms. Connie Orton Bell, complained to the employer about that, that that should not be happening. The employer said that she should wash her desk every morning and that her assistant should do so as well. She complained to the employer that they should not have, the women should not have to wash down their desks every morning.
You know, it seems to me that the case comes down to whether your client and Mr. Dittmer were similarly situated. But there seems to be nothing in the record about what she appealed to what body, when, you know, was she within the statute of limitations? Did she appeal the right issue? Did she appeal to the correct body? Is any of that in the record?
Let's see. I'm struggling to figure out exactly what that's addressing. I don't recognize it as issues in the briefs. Perhaps.
But you see, that would answer the question of whether, you know, they were similarly situated.
Oh, you're talking about the appeal that the district court said she did not appeal. I'm sorry, I apologize. I was thinking in court terms. Yes, she followed all the paperwork. She testified and did appeal through all the procedures and finally did win her unemployment benefits. And the parties are in agreement, fortunately, on several things in this case, and that is what the parties are now in agreement on. They were always in agreement on that, and the state never claimed that she did not appeal. I don't know where
that's the just something the district court got wrong.
It did. Mm-hmm. That error was the basis of the entire decision of the district court, because the district court said that since she did not appeal, she was not discriminated against, she was not retaliated against, and that was an important piece of the hostile work environment. And I apologize, Judge, to that appeal that I was not thinking about, but the parties are in agreement that she did appeal and finally obtained her unemployment benefits.
And for details, we find that in the plaintiff's deposition?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the state did not argue that she didn't meet any statute of limitation on her appeal or anything like that, and we're in agreement. We were in agreement all during the proceedings that she appealed. That was not an issue. But thank you for raising that, because I, as you could see, I wasn't concentrating on that, so thank you very much for asking. When she did complain, she complained not only to Internal Affairs but also to the superintendent. And the superintendent reiterated the employer's position that the employer did not care about people having sex on her desk as long as it was consensual between staff members, did not involve offenders.
Comfortable, doesn't it?
Well, yes. Yes, absolutely. She had been the subject of sexual statements and sexual harassment for some time, and the only thing I can think of is that perhaps other staff got some sort of enjoyment or revenge or something out of this particular activity, but you're absolutely right.
Was this superintendent that she complained to the same one that she testified told her to come to meetings so he could look at her?
I believe
somebody
that's
else?
A different one.
Okay.
Because the first one, I believe, was identified as Superintendent Mize, M-I-Z-E. Second superintendent, I believe, was Superintendent Finnan, F-I-N-N-A-N. And so...
Was the second one the one that that fired her, I guess?
Yes.
No, he wasn't on very long, was he?
Pardon me?
He hadn't been there very long, had he?
He followed Mize, and I think each of them had been there roughly a year, a matter of months, something like that. And the superintendent, as I understand it, makes the decisions, and then the actual meeting and firing is carried out by an assistant usually. So I don't remember exactly who was at the meeting, but the decision made by the superintendent.
Maybe it was the wrong impression, but I thought someone came in to try to clean this place up, which is obviously a pretty horrible employment situation.
Yes. I think the state is learning. You know, we certainly hope that. That's one of the purposes of lawsuits. And
that wasn't the new superintendent. That wasn't one of his goals or something.
Oh, it may have been. I think probably each superintendent
wants
to do better,
else.
But I don't think he was known for that.
Okay.
So we make progress, you know, one case at a time, and hopefully as we go through case after case, things do get better. So
it doesn't help when your client has affair with the major, and which is just an outright violation.
I'm sorry,
that's
I didn't hear.
Right. I'm having a little problem talking today. So
I had a little trouble hearing, too.
Well, maybe I'll go a little louder. As far as his name, Orton, what was the person that seemed to be having an affair with everybody, including her?
Major Dittmer.
I'm sorry, Dittmer.
Major in charge Dittmer, of custody.
She and Dittmer had both married and had an affair in the location as well as somewhere else. And that was discovered, and they were both terminated.
They were both married. She was separated and was living in a separate house, which she moved just down the road from her employment. So she was not living with her husband. He said he was getting a divorce. He did not follow through with that. But they were then dating in a situation. Surprise, surprise. But they were dating in a situation where it was her understanding that they were both getting a divorce. So
I guess she claims most of the sexual activity took place in her nearby house.
Oh, yes.
To his office.
Yes. Yeah, and as speaking
not
to Judge Holder's
desk. At least.
No, no. It doesn't make any sense for her to do that, as Judge Rovner said, because she's got a house just down the street. And so you know, it's sort of titillating to talk about their sexual relationship, but, you know, we all have consensual sexual relationships. We all hope to, at least. And we all have...
This was pervasive throughout the prison, it seems.
I
had trouble distinguishing her from everybody else. It seemed to be having a sexual banter and joking and knowing about it, but the only complaint is just, they did this on my desk.
Yes, you are absolutely correct. And it was accepted there. And so...
Everyone knows that, you know.
Now. We're trying to improve. We're trying to improve. So, yes, you are correct that did go on. She objected to some of the worst violations, more thorough searches of her, you know, telling her not to wear things, telling her to be at a meeting so he could look at her, and she objected to some of the worst things. But then, you know, when she complained about something that should have been corrected, then they jump up and attack her and then treat her differently than the male. And, you know, if there's a tragedy.
She was 2 years and he was 20 years, something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
There's some differences.
So if there's anybody that knew the policies, it was this guy who'd been there for years.
Mr. Darcy, could I ask you to clarify a couple of factual matters, please? The plaintiff came up with this new treatment program.
Yes.
And was told not to apply for the bonus that, for which she might be eligible.
Yes.
First of all, do we know in the record whether anybody got a bonus for that new program?
We do not.
Okay.
So the evidence on retaliation is that she was told not to.
Right. And then
she would lose her job.
One other question. There's an issue about reduction of duties.
Yes.
Can you just explain to me in what way were her responsibilities reduced, and was it connected with that new program that was set up?
It may have been. I don't think the record is clear on that. And the state says that the state gives an explanation that they want to present to the jury. The evidence is undisputed that her duties were reduced after she had been complaining about sexual harassment. And frankly,
in terms of supervision.
Yes.
Okay.
Frankly, I don't think the record shows exactly how that came about.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, Ms. Barrow.
May it please the court, my name is Frances Barrow. I represent the state. The district court properly granted summary judgment in favor of the state on Connie Orton Bell's Title VII claims. She and Major Joe Dittmer both were fired at the same time because an investigation showed that they were having sexual relations at the workplace, which was the Pendleton Correctional Facility.
Then why did the forms that were sent by the employer to the unemployment office say different things?
Well, the forms didn't ask the same things. The form, for some reason, that applied to Ms. Orton Bell asked an additional question to supply a detail regarding the reason for the discharge.
But doesn't the employer have the obligation to ensure that two employees fired for the exact same conduct on the same date and at the same time and the same place are treated the same throughout the discharge and unemployment process?
Well, in comparing that process, the state did oppose benefits for both of them. That's why we have those forms from the claims deputy. The claims deputy only comes into play when the employer objects to somebody receiving benefits. The fact that whoever filled out the forms added that detail on one form because there was a question asked and not the other, I'm not sure that's necessarily actionable, especially when there were separate claims deputies considering the claims. So the outcome of the unemployment process is really not determinative of unequal treatment following their termination. Neither was the SEAC appeal process. We have no details from her appeal, where she has found significant documentation from Joe Dittmer's appeal. And she has not shown how or why her process was different, whether there were any settlement discussions. Was she willing to dismiss her complaint? That was one of the provisos in the settlement with Major Dittmer, that he did dismiss all of his claims. Was she willing to do that? If she's saying that this was a source of unequal treatment, should have provided some more information to show exactly how the state behaved differently in her appeal than it did in Major Dittmer's appeal. And we don't.
Could I ask you a question about termination? The plaintiff complained to the authorities at Pendleton about other employees having sex in her office. Were those employees violating the same standard or different standards than she and Dittmer were?
Well, the standards, first of all, I would say that I don't think any employer thinks of putting into an employee handbook, employees shall not have sexual relations at the workplace. And what's assumed is in the standards for professionalism,
right,
for integrity, that your personal conduct would be above reproach.
Mm-hmm.
And so
same standards were being same expectations were being violated by all those employees.
Well, interestingly, as far as having sexual relations on the premises, the record does show that the former superintendent, Mize, was fired for that reason, that he and a nurse in the infirmary apparently had. And so he was treated the same as she and Major Dittmer.
That's nice. That's not the question I asked. Okay? The question I asked was about the people that the plaintiff complained about.
Okay. Sorry.
Having sexual relations in her office, which, to make the point that I'm concerned about, apparently did not trouble the people that she complained to.
That is her inference, that and I want to go through that whole process, that she was concerned that people were coming into her office after hours, maybe using her computer, maybe it was offenders coming into her office. Okay, she did not at that time say people are having sex on my desk. She was just concerned that people were coming into her office. So Terry Silvers of Internal Affairs investigated. He comes to her on a Thursday, March 4, and says, well, the good news is nobody's coming into your office and using your computer. The bad news is people are having sex on your desk. Now, her inference is that he was dead serious, that he didn't care that people had sex on her desk, and neither did Superintendent Finnan. We just have that scenario of that conversation with, yeah, people are having sex on your desk, and it became a big joke. That's why she ended up complaining the next day that people were laughing at her.
Sure.
And go ahead.
Sorry. Is that an unreasonable inference on her part?
Well, I would say it is, in light of the fact that, we know that people are fired for that same conduct,
but apparently there was no interest here.
Well, that's right. We have her testimony about the statements.
So why isn't it a reasonable inference that a double standard was being applied to her her conduct as opposed to others?
Well,
her testimony, complaining about the sexualized, hostile environment at the prison.
Well, in this particular instance, is that different treatment based on gender?
For example, complaints.
I beg your pardon?
Or complaints about a sexually hostile environment.
As far as people having sex on her desk, if that were true, her inference is it's only because she was a woman. And that's not a reasonable inference, because people would find a place where they could close the door and have privacy, and she wasn't there after hours. And so the idea that they singled her out as a woman is just, I think the district court actually specifically rejected that inference as conduct that was based on her gender.
Two questions, different branching in different directions. Do you think the response would have been similar if it had been happening with other employees in Superintendent Mize's office? And second, is it a reasonable inference that she was being treated differently because she had been complaining about a hostile environment?
Okay. As the court noted earlier, there was a difference in the atmosphere at the prison under Superintendent Mize and Superintendent Finnan. Superintendent Mize left in the summer of 2009.
I'm sorry. Could you answer my question and then give me the background, please?
Sure. So the question was, would there have been a different response under Superintendent Mize?
That's one. And the other question is whether it's a reasonable inference that she was treated the way she was because she had complained about a hostile environment.
That is not a reasonable inference, and that is her sole claim on the retaliation claim, that the idea that she was fired because she was having sex with Major Dittmer at the facility was not the real reason she was fired, that the superintendent was upset that she complained. And she has put into evidence the affidavit of her coworker, Diane Ritberger, who apparently complained about exactly the same thing. And she was not fired. why would they fire Connie Orton Bell and not her coworker for exactly the same conduct that occurred at exactly the same time? So, and that is one of the elements under the indirect method for retaliation, to show a causal connection between the protected activity and the adverse employment decision. And we are not conceding that her complaint was even protected activity.
Are you? Do you continue to argue that Orton Bell and Dittmer are not similarly situated?
Yes. They were not similarly situated. She would have to show that they had the same job description, were subject to the same standards, the same supervisor, and had comparable experience, education, and other qualifications.
Well, if the state claimed that it was downsizing or that firing off the less qualified worker. But in this case, it is undisputed that both parties were fired for the same offense, having sex at work with each other. So for the purposes of their termination, they are absolutely similarly situated.
Well, and the other element that she has to show is that she was meeting her employer's legitimate job expectations, and this conduct is
not,
very far.
Not when it's a discriminatory discipline case. That's elementary. You cannot beat a discrimination case by saying both of these people misbehaved. We treated one more gently than the other, but the fact that they were misbehaving ends the issue and resolves the case.
Well, but we dispute that they were, one was treated more gently, that they were both.
That's
terminated.
A different question.
Okay.
But you can't avoid the prima facie case by arguing that they were misbehaving.
Well, I don't think she has disputed that somebody having, well, actually she does, but I think it's that having sex at the workplace is misbehaving, and that is what...
Of course.
And I'm not understanding the question. I'm sorry.
Obviously not. Let me try again. It is well established in our case law that the employment discrimination laws protect people who are imperfect employees, who break the rules. You don't have to be a perfect employee, but an employer who is disciplining employees who break rules, who perform poorly, cannot discriminate on the basis of race, sex, religion, disability, etc., in imposing discipline. So we adapt the McDonnell-Douglas test in such cases, as we have repeatedly explained, by collapsing the second and fourth elements and saying what you really have to do is show somebody similarly situated in terms of misbehavior. If you want to take a look, I think the Coleman case from late 2011 is probably, or early 2012 is a good example. But there are many, many in our case law.
Okay, if the question is whether two employees can both be termed, if the female employee makes a prima facie case of sex discrimination, I'm not familiar with the Coleman case, but I'm saying that in this case, the behavior was sufficiently egregious that the termination...
Let me put it this way. Suppose, do you think it would have been a violation of Title VII or permissible under Title VII for the state to give Major Dittmer a warning and to fire Ms. Orton Bell?
Yes.
Yes, which?
Well, if they only gave him a warning and fired her, that would have been an issue under Title VII.
Okay. That's the issue we've got here. It's just more subtle.
Mm-hmm. If that has to do with the subsequent events after the termination?
The state of Indiana is the employer throughout, right?
Correct. And she has not, even the undisputed evidence does not show that the state treated him more gently than it treated her.
Oh, of course it does. He's, you know, he comes on back.
Well, again, we have no evidence from her appeal to know what her demands were, what the state asked of her. We simply do not know. And so it's, how has she made a prima facie case based on the SEAC appeal when there was no evidence regarding that appeal? Specifically, no evidence about what the state did or did not do. And for these reasons...
How do I know what the state did? There's no evidence.
But her argument is that the state treated her worse. And if, you know, in what way? She says, well, the state didn't settle with me. Well, we don't know why. She doesn't say why. She doesn't say what her demands were, what the state's demands were. It's simply a lack of evidence. And
I thought she said she was fired under circumstances that prevented her from returning. Dittmer was not. Does she have to prove more? Or is that sufficient to ask the state to justify the differential treatment?
Well, I don't think the state was ever asked to justify that. She simply insisted that the state treated him better, and yet...
Well, he's still there, isn't he?
That's what she's testified to, yes.
Well, is that right? Mm. Surely you know whether he's employed or not, right? Mm.
As far as I don't know if he's employed with the state or with a contractor with the state, or indeed today whether he's employed. I don't know that.
Hey.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want to add anything?
I would ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Durst have? Okay.
Thank you very much. In our reply brief, and that was just filed last week, so I hope you have it. I don't know.
Oh, of course, and we have read it.
Thank you. On page 12, we note that, first of all, the state says, well, we don't know what evidence there is here or there or whatever. The state did not make it an issue and did not offer evidence. The state obviously knows what its own SEAC papers show, State Employees Appeals Commission, but the reply brief points out that plaintiff testified in her deposition that all she wanted was for the state to allow her to have unemployment and to wipe her record clean so that it did not state that she was terminated for that reason, but the state denied her request. She requested less than the state gave to Dittmer, but the state denied her request for less relief than it gave to Dittmer. State does not claim that it made any offer to her at all, nor did the state claim in her deposition that it made any offer. The state has never offered and still does not offer to change her termination to a resignation as it did for Dittmer, or to allow her to have employment with the state. So it's continuing to be a black mark on her record. She's been denied employment with the state, denied employment with the contractors, and cannot work for the state, and most people don't want to hire her if she's been terminated by the state. As to Mr. Mize, he was terminated for having sex with a subordinate, which does not apply to my client. So he was not terminated for just having sex at the institution.
Would that have applied to Dittmer? Or was there a different line of authority?
A good question, Judge. It's my understanding that Dittmer and my client were co-equal on the chart, but that he had much more authority. He had authority over all the custody people, and he had much more experience and knowledge of the facility and the policies. So plaintiff was treated differently than Dittmer, than Silver. Silvers, the internal affairs investigator who told my client that the employer doesn't care and about the sex in the facility. Now, this was consistent with my client's understanding that people date there, people get married there, people have sex there, even on the facility, because they even house some of those people there, their spouses and their girlfriends, not for the same people, but spouses or girlfriends, I should say. And now the state implies on appeal, well, maybe they were just joking. They weren't joking. That's what the situation was at the facility at the time. We're trying to improve it. But you cannot, the state cannot, and no party can come to this court and say, well, maybe this or maybe that. There's an obligation to introduce evidence that they have. They run the state. They run the facility. They run SEAC. They know what it is. They didn't offer any evidence in that respect or make these things an issue. Plaintiff was also treated differently than, as you point out, the people who were having sex on her desk. And this hint of a joke, this was maybe a joke, this wasn't any joke. They told her to wash down her desk every day. They told her assistant to wash down her desk every day. If this was a joke, which there's no evidence it was a cruel joke and harassment and more harassment, and then made her the brunt of the joke of the whole institution, because it became, as the state says, a big joke and further humiliating her. But there's no evidence that it was a joke. The state says that something about expectations is not in the handbook. These statements that this was allowed was stated directly to her. My time is up. Thank you very much for your time.
If you have another thought, you certainly...
No, you've been great.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much. And the case will be taken under advisement.